My name is Gerhard Kempf. I'm a Lutheran missionary for the Hispanics and with the Hispanics in the Yakima Valley of the state of Washington. And I'm speaking on different aspects of Hispanic ministry this week. Tonight, after a little bit, I want to kind of give some... How many of you have been in some of the sessions before on Hispanic ministry? Okay. I'm going to give you a little bit of a test, or at least to talk about. And not really a test, but just to see, lay out to you some of the things that people say to us about our ministry, kind of negative things, and see how you would react to them. Last night we were talking about how to reach out to Hispanics, and the discussion went on rather long, so I didn't quite get to finish some of the things that I wanted to say about some kinds of outreach to Hispanics that are not effective, that we've found out over the years are not really all that effective. One of them is canvassing. The reason behind that is if you go out and canvass people and ask them questions, Hispanics will not respond to you. Unless, or if they do, because they don't want to seem impolite, they will tell you what they think you want to hear. So your information might be accurate, it might not be accurate. Okay. Hi, up there, are you? I didn't notice you up there before. I'm not used to having people up there. Thank you. Another way of, for the same reason perhaps, door-to-door invitations to bring people into church are not very effective either. People will be polite to you, but again, they won't give you any information because they have no relationship with you yet. They don't know who you are, they don't know if you can be trusted, they don't know if what you're going to do with the information that they might give to you, and so they will not either give you the invitation, or they'll just say, well, thank you very much for the invitation, and that'll be the end of the conversation. But you probably will never see them. So you might say the same thing for distributing literature. It's not very effective either, because they'll take it and they'll look at it, but since it comes from somebody that's anonymous because it was just left there and there's no personal contact there at all, they wouldn't respond to that either. They might read whatever literature you left there, but they probably would not respond on the whole. The other thing that is done much, a good deal, by the evangelicals in Latin America and also here is to have evangelistic campaigns, revival type of campaigns. And again, for some of the same reasons, those are not very effective. A lot of people might come forward because they're caught up in the emotion of the moment, and they might want to confess their sins or something else like that, but they probably will not make a commitment, or at least not a firm commitment, unless something else is going on and they can have some kind of conversation with a counselor that somehow is able in a rather rapid time to create some kind of a relationship or rapport with them. You do make a few contacts here and there, people that are more open or maybe have heard about you if you've been in the neighborhood for a while, but on the whole, those are not very effective methods. Surely not as effective as they are when we work in among Anglos. So to reiterate what I wanted to end up with last night, and I did say it, I think, for some people at least, a good start, if you want to really begin work among Hispanics, a good start is to become a friend. No matter where you are in your understanding of the Hispanic culture, of the people, of their language, or anything else, if you can make contact with them, be friendly with them, and show them that you really just want to be friends. Not in order to help them, not in order to give them something that you think you have to give them, at least not at the beginning, until you have established this kind of confidence, this kind of trust, a trust level is really what it is, with the people, but to listen to them, to learn from them, and to relate to them, and build that kind of relationship, that's a start. That's, I think, the basic way to start. When a relationship has been built, and over the time you will probably know when that has happened, you will be able to feel that, particularly if they start telling you about themselves rather extensively or about their personal problems, then it will be possible for you to give a greater and a stronger witness to them, to the gospel, and there's a good chance that the gospel will take root in them, then they will listen to it and carry through on it. Okay? Yes, do you have any questions?
From what you said yesterday and then today just now, yesterday you mentioned something about that most Hispanic people can really tell if you're trying to make friends with them for a reason other than what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like if you're trying to make friends with them so that you can convert them. How, you know, when their culture is so much different than the average American culture, or not American, the average white culture, you know, won't they be suspicious of why we want to make friends?
No, because their whole life is oriented towards people, and they will see you as another person. A person in your own right, they will respect your ideas and all of that. They might not believe it, they might not be convinced, you know, at the beginning until you have this trust relationship built up. But they will see you as a person, they will be interested in you as a person. For who you are, for the kind of person that you are, and they will also be interested in trying to find out what kind of person you are. And so they make that kind of contact very readily. What's that?
They won't be suspicious, you know, why is this woman trying to be my friend?
There might be people that do that, you know. I think it would be rather rare. Because for many of them, especially for the undocumented that have been kind of set aside from the whole social fabric, you know, and keep their own, they have to keep their own, among their own people, their relationships, they're kind of anxious to reach out to other people. They're anxious to have people be interested in them too. So I don't think you have to worry about that kind of thing. Okay. But make sure that your own concern, that your desire to be friends with them is a sincere desire. Because, as I said yesterday, they are very much quicker at picking up on anything that's phony about you than we are, because our minds are set kind of in a different direction and not so much people oriented, and they feel that a lot, men and women. Perhaps you heard this morning that somebody said that women have an instinctive feeling for what you're trying to say or what you have in your mind. A wife will say to her husband, "Oh, I know just what you're thinking," and she's probably right. But the men in our culture don't do that, you know, they don't pick up on that because they're told to keep their feelings to themselves. And so they are not in tune with other people's feelings as much as the women are. But in Hispanic society, that's not true of men. They're very much attuned to that, just as the women are here among us. Okay, there are a couple of things that we hear quite a bit, kind of in criticism of our ministry, even from people who are Lutheran, or sometimes from the people who are within the congregations that are sponsoring our work in Yakima Valley. And this is true not only here, but also in Texas, where I served, or wherever that you will find Hispanics, and particularly undocumented Hispanics. And I'd just like to throw a couple of those out to you and see if you're interested in making some kind of response. If you feel like you'd like to respond to that, how would you feel, or what would you say to somebody that said that kind of thing to you, to see if we can generate a little bit discussion rather than me just talking here like I have been for the first half hour up till now. One of the things that we run into pretty often is the concept of the melting pot. People will say, well, the Mexicans that come up here and all these foreigners, what they have to do is become like us. They have to learn our culture and our ways and become part of the melting pot. Would you have any concept or any ideas about how you might respond to something like that? Or maybe you don't want to play this game, I don't know, but...
Well, I don't think it's really fair to ask them to become part of the melting pot and lose all of their identity by any means. I think they should be able to keep part of their, keeps their culture, but they do, they conform to a lot of the rules that we have, but I still don't think it's fair to take all their culture away from them by any means. We certainly deserve to keep that.
Right. Yeah.
Actually, if we can show them that we appreciate their culture, because our whole American society is full of different cultures from all over the world, mm-hmm. and it's just one aspect that would enrich our culture to have them part of us.
I think a lot of that came back to a lot of people when they came to this country from Europe, and that they decided they were going to become Americans. I know in my husband's own family, his parents came from Norway and they were going to become good Americans, and as a result of it, the children and my husband and his brothers and sisters were growing up. They lost a lot of their Norwegian heritage mm-hmm. that in later years they started wanting to find out more about it. They didn't even hear a lot about the family that was left in Norway. We found out more about it when we made a trip to mm-hmm. Norway to mm-hmm. visit.
Sure.
And I think it's just unfair. I think we should have this variety of cultures. And
okay.
I think there's things we can learn from them, too.
That's right.
Yeah, right. Of course, every culture has its good things and bad things,
right?
So,
mm-hmm.
And we understand that. There are a couple of other things, too, that need to... Does anybody else want to say something? There's a couple of things that I would add to that, just to help broaden your understanding of what the Hispanics are like and what... One of the things is that the Hispanics... are not all here to be Americanized. And I think probably most of them are not. Part of the reason for that is it's so easy, I think I mentioned this one time before, it's so easy for them to go back from here to Mexico. The ties with their families left back in Mexico or in whatever other country of Central or South America they come from, the family ties are so strong that becomes a priority item for them. We know a number of people that are here that are refugees. The Salvadoran family, for instance, that are refugees. She left two of her children, her small children, in San Salvador, and they were afraid that he was going to be killed, and so they came up here, and they did not receive asylum here, and the thing is still pending, but in the meantime they can't leave the country and they really can't go back to El Salvador because they might pick them up and do them in, and that's a very real thing. Now she has two children here, but what I hear about her is almost like an obsession to get back and get those children and bring the family back together, which you can all understand very much, but also to see her mother and her father, and he wants to see. Well, his mother died while he was up here last year, and that was a terrible blow for him. He couldn't even go back for the funeral, and so these ties are very, very strong, and they will spend money, lots of money, for travel back and forth to see family, and lots of time which we might spend on something else. Okay. Okay, that's one of the reasons. So they can do it, and they want to go back. And the other thing is that they don't really want to give up their culture. And that's very strong. It's, I think, for many people coming over from Europe, it was easier to adapt to the melting pot concept, because there are so many more similarities between the two cultures. There's kind of a pretty common way of thinking from people of Northern Europe and the North American culture. At least it's a lot closer than it is between the Hispanics. I want to go into some of those differences next week in a couple of the sessions that we have next week. And I think you might find that very interesting. But there's a wide diversity there. And it's much more difficult for Hispanics to enter into our mindset for that very reason than it is for other European immigrants coming in, from Northern Europe, let me say. The people from Southern Europe probably find the same problems. And then the family unity that you find among Hispanics also helps them to kind of keep together to their own national group. Now, there's some good things about that, and there's some bad things, but it's a reality, and that's what I'm just trying to show you, without judging which is good and which is bad. You know. So I think some of those things would be good for you to think about. And hopefully also, it seems to me, from our point of view, we should recognize the fact that there is not... That concept of the melting pot is not all that great anymore. You know, it's not all that that universal. There are a lot of people, because of the plurality of peoples that we have and the influx of refugees from Asia and from Africa and from Poland and from, well, wherever they all have been coming from Haiti and so on, that there's a lot of more understanding that diversity is a good thing among us. Not everybody is demanding anymore. A lot of people are not demanding anymore that you become just like me, otherwise you can't be part of the society, you see. And I think that's a good thing, because I see all of these differences, as well as the similarities, have come from one source, and that's God, right? He made those people. And there's a lot of factors that shape their history and their way of thinking, but basically at the beginning God made all of these people, and he gives them their culture, and he works with them through their own culture. And he calls them out of their own culture and their own language. And that's an important thing. For me and my culture and my language, that's important for me to know that, because I feel secure with that kind of thing. And so we can, at least as Christians, we can be probably more tolerant of that than others. There's a lot of propaganda here about the language, particularly in schools, bilingual education. I realize there's some problems there, but among the Hispanics at least, the concept for bilingual education is not simply to substitute Spanish, let's say, or Vietnamese, or whatever the language needs to be, to substitute that language for English, but it's to use that language while the children still understand that language and don't understand English, and teach them in that language until their English is good enough so that they can be taught in English and keep up with their peers in the class. And for some children, that could happen in one school year. For others, it might take two or three school years.
I think probably with the Vietnamese people and that come in there, they stay in one area or stay in an area longer, whereas with your migrant workers, it must be a real task to try and have the children in school and teach them.
Well, that's the big problem. The children of migrant workers are very, very, very behind in education, and that's one of the real big problems. But I think there's less of migrant workers now, mm-hmm. or families of migrant workers. They seem to be deciding to stay in certain areas. So we have a lot of permanent residents now in some of these pockets of Hispanic culture than we used to have. So that's, but there still are plenty of them. But we see the effects of that in the children. They can't read either Spanish or English, and they talk both very poorly, and very often don't quite understand what you're saying to them. Okay. All right, we've also had some people complain very much that we are working with undocumented workers. This is a true story. One lady wrote a letter and said, "Why are we working with these people who are illegally? That's against the law. And the Lutheran Church shouldn't support that." And her contention was then that we ought to teach them the gospel and send them back to Mexico.
Oh dear.
Well,
many of them know the gospel better than we do.
Yeah, that's true. And also, it's not our job to send people back to Mexico. You know, that's what we have an immigration service for. They do the job too well already. We don't have to do that. The other thing is, which a lot of people don't recognize, is that when people get deported back, particularly the men, they get picked up in the fields or something, deported back to Mexico often within 2 days, they're back up in the Yakima Valley. And they just go down there and they come across the river again, maybe that same day, get on a bus and come on back up here. You know. And so, you know, you read about all of these millions of people that have been deported, but we don't know how many of the same people have been deported, because I know a lot of them that have been here 19, 20 years, never been deported, and others that have been deported 4 or 5 times, you know, in just maybe a year or 2 years. You just don't know.
Lives down in Vista, California, and I was amazed last winter when I was down there, and I was going over to visit my niece, who lives about 12 or 13 miles from there. Yeah, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and there were trucks out with baked goods and coffee and that. And I was just amazed at the number of Mexicans that were coming out of the woods down to get food.
Yeah.
And they go back up there, and they live under a tree or someplace down in Southern California. It's just unreal.
They keep a low profile.
And this is one of my first contacts, the last couple of times I've been to California, to realize how much of this it is. And then my husband built a rock wall at our son-in-law's place, and they needed someone to help. And they just got to these meeting places, and they pick up someone. This Mexican man came and worked like a trooper, and he had lunch with us, and he didn't say much, but he was just happy to get a few days' work. And
yeah,
we live out this area, like over something on the east-west side of the mountains, and we just don't get in contact with these things until you get into the Yakima Valley or get in someplace and see it and realize just what is going on.
Well, our concern is with the gospel, right? Our concern is to help them. Actually, when people get deported sometimes, if they have been in contact with the church, it's kind of a blessing in one way, because they carry the gospel back down and it gets spread out through the whole family, through the extended family. The advantage to that is that the Mexican law, Mexican constitution, does not allow any foreigner to teach religion to the Mexicans, to Mexican nationals. And so we can't send missionaries down there like we do to other countries. There are some ways that you can partially get around that, but primarily you have to have Mexicans teaching Mexicans. So that's an excellent avenue to bring the gospel to a lot of people that we wouldn't be able to reach otherwise.
Is Mexico one of the only countries in Central America or South America that prevents that ban?
As far as I know, yes.
Why would that be?
There was a very strong anti-clerical movement during the Mexican Revolution in the early 1900s, 1918 to 20, I think it was. Because of many of the abuses and that the church had gobbled up so much land in Mexico. And part of the revolution was to make it possible for the peasants to have their own land. It's kind of a land reform thing. And as a result, the feeling against the Roman Catholic Church because of that was so strong that they wrote it into the Constitution. Churches, for instance, no church in Mexico belongs to any church, any denominational group. It's all national property, and the government allows you to use that building, but they could take it away from you at any moment if they wanted to. That's all part of their law and their constitution. It doesn't happen much anymore. It doesn't happen that way, but it's on the books. Okay. All right. How about this? It should be easy for us to get Hispanics into our congregations because as a Lutheran church, we have liturgy and we have rites and many of the people, I don't know how many of you are all Lutheran, maybe some of you are not, but we use the same kind of rites and ceremonies and so forth. So it should be easy for Hispanics to join our churches. Why do we want to establish separate Hispanic missions or congregations?
Well, maybe.
Okay. Not too many Lutheran churches have a lot of Hispanic people, that's right. To this point.
Wouldn't most of them be Catholic?
Most of them are Catholic, at least by name. But only maybe 10 to 15% is a very common estimate are active Catholics.
But they would still have that identity.
Yeah, they would call themselves Catholic if you ask them. For instance, if you go canvassing, that's the standard answer you get. Well, I'm Catholic.
I think that's a you're having a problem of all. I'm not sure what you discussed before, but if you're bringing that up.
Go ahead.
It has just been the, I think, nature of certain cultural, you know, ethnic groups to join together, and there's some commonality, and I suppose that's what we seek here as we talk about the rainbow and many other things, is that how do we seek an outreach for people to come into our particular church body, or our church, our congregation center. And I assume that, but I suppose our real goal is to reach out to those who are not church in any way at all. I think that's what you're doing. I assume that's what you're doing down in the Yakima Valley.
Right, right. We're trying to
see Norwegians, just like the Norwegians come together. I mean, you got to, you know, a Norwegian coming from abroad even today, well, they'll have a tendency to go to an area where there are, where they have some cultural affinity.
Okay, that's a good point. I'd like to point out, I don't see too much, too many of you anxious to add anything to this. I'd like to point out a couple of other things in case it ever gets to the point where you are that there's a possibility for Hispanics to be coming to your church. Or if some of them might happen to drop in, they do that once in a while, into your church. Apart from the language question, you know, of course, if they don't know English, it's going to be difficult for them to want to join an English-speaking church. But there are other kinds of things that we ought to perhaps keep in mind. And one is that in the Hispanic culture, there's a lot of individualism. Hispanics are not joiners, okay? You don't find all kinds of clubs in an organization for this group of people, an organization for that group of people, and so on, in Mexico or in Latin America, not nearly to the extent that you do here. Okay. Political parties, perhaps, but on a social level, very, very little of that. And so it's kind of not part of their culture to be joining something. Another thing to keep in mind is that their concept of what the church is different. Their experience of what the church is different than we expect, particularly among the Protestants. The Protestants all expect their members to maintain the church, to support the church financially, with involvement and otherwise. In Latin America, it isn't that way. The church is there. It's kind of like a, you might say, a corner grocery. You walk by it 16,000 times a day, and you never go in, you never give it a thought, unless you have some need. there's something in that store that you need to buy, you'll go in and buy it and then go out and forget about the store. And that's the way they feel about the church. The church is always standing there. The church is open if you need it for baptisms, for confirmation, or for private prayer to go in during the day. You go to church, and if you don't feel the need for it, you don't go. There are probably a lot of North Americans that feel the same way, that react the same way. But this is very common, because the priest isn't that involved with the people either. And because of the whole kind of folk Catholicism that has risen, in which people do their own worship, their own thing with God. And they have their own concepts of who God is and what God is and how they should serve Him and so forth. Okay, now, that's another thing.
Excuse me, how does that fit with the base communities where we've lived in under Liberation Theology?
Okay, the basic Christian communities are now growing quite a bit. You probably know that. And that's a new development since the late 60s, okay, in the 70s and up until now. And that's quite different, where you have these small groups. It's really a small group ministry of people that get together that have their own leader. Sometimes it might be the priest or a pastor. Most of the time it's a lay person out of their own group. And that is a forum in which they discuss all kinds of things, anything that pertains to their life. Politics, economics, whether they need a well, whether they need a road built, you know, how they can get along with people if they have a drunkard in the group, or what they can do to help him, and anybody that has some personal problems, if they want to discuss it with the group. You know, once the trust level is built there, all of these kind of things will come out in these small basic Christian communities. Also, there's a lot of Bible study. And they sit and reflect, what does this Bible say to me? You know, what does this particular passage say to me? If some of you were here when Susan had a Bible class, I think it was Wednesday morning, showing how people reflect in these base communities, asking three questions, you know. What did Jesus say? What did Jesus do? Who opposed him? And what was the benefit of what he did? Who benefited by it? And then what would we do like Jesus did? And who would oppose us in our own context in life? And who would benefit by what we're doing? And as you sit and answer and reflect on all these questions, you know, a lot of neat things come up. And there's built a real sense of community. So it's quite different, you know, and I think that's a strong catalyst for change in Latin America. But a lot of the people that we have now haven't had that opportunity, because many of them have been here, or they haven't been in areas where these base communities have been developed, especially among the Mexicans. Doesn't seem to be as strong in Mexico, as far as I know, as in other countries. One of the other things that you need to be sensitive to, I think, is that when you are a minority person and you come into a majority church with a certain culture and a certain way of doing things, you recognize the need to conform to that, but you always feel like a minority. Pastor Pete Perro was talking about that, I think, this morning or yesterday. That you're in there and you're accepted up to a certain level, but actually, as far as the decision making is concerned, you really have no power, because you're only one vote, you know, or just a few votes, and you really can't get into the whole structure, the power structure and the decision making structure in the congregation, which generally stays with the white people. And that tends to make you feel inferior. You probably wouldn't get elected to office or anything like that. And so if people do come in and you want them to become part of your congregation, it's important that you take that into consideration and help them to see that they really are or make them, help them become a real part of the decision-making process. They're also not used to the way decisions are made. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Acts chapter 15, the Jerusalem Council, where the apostles got together to decide the question whether Gentiles could be brought into the church without being put under the Mosaic law, and how the decision was made there. It says there was a long discussion. Presumably, anybody and everybody could speak out. Then Peter got up and talked about his experience with Cornelius. And then Paul and Barnabas, who were the representatives from the Gentile church of Antioch in Syria, they got up and they explained and told what God had done for the Gentiles through them in their first missionary journey around Asia Minor. And then after all of this, you read something that's rather striking. It says James, who was obviously the leader of the chairman of the meeting, James says, "It is my judgment that we should do so and so and so and so," and that's what they did. Now the question is, did James make a decision on his own? There was not a majority vote. There was no motion made and seconded and passed. It's a different way of making a decision. And when that was pointed out to me several years ago by one of our professors at Concordia College in Austin, Texas, I immediately saw that's the way things are done in the congregation that I was serving, a Hispanic congregation. There was this one man who had been the leader of the congregation during the time of the interim before I got there, kind of had held the whole congregation together. When there was a meeting, he would just kind of sit back in the corner and you didn't hear much from him, occasionally something. But then when it seemed like all the conversation and all the argumentation back and forth was petering out, then he would say, "Well, I think we ought to maybe do so and so." What he was doing was gathering the consensus, realizing what the consensus of the group was through all of the conversation, and then reflecting that and saying, "This is the way we ought to do it." And of course people felt, "Yes, this is what we have been deciding to do." And he formulated it, and so okay, they would accept it. That's a different way of making decisions, so they're not used to making all kinds of motions and going by Robert's Rules of Order and all that kind of thing. So that also needs to be taken into consideration if you can be sensitive to that and help these people get through some of those things. Okay, I don't want to say any more about this unless you have some more questions here or some remarks that you would like to make. Okay, how about another one? There's no need for us to learn Hispanic culture, since they should become one of us and learn our culture rather than we learn theirs. Have you ever thought that in your own mind? How would you answer it if you did? What would you say to yourself?
Being lazy.
Huh?
It's being lazy.
Being lazy? Okay.
Complacent.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important that if we want to reach them, you need to know their culture. You need to know some of the differences, because it's so easy to say something or to do something which will become offensive to them, which will be offensive to them because it's against their culture and they have not yet learned to appreciate, you know, that mistakes between cultures can be made sometimes, you know. They do the same thing. You may feel the same thing to them, you know, that they speak kind of a broken English and they will say something to you that really is, you know, really is an offensive thing in English. But they don't realize it because they're translating into English from their own Spanish way of thinking and their own Spanish words. And so they say it that way. Sometimes it turns out to be kind of funny or quaint, but sometimes it actually becomes offensive, you know,
I think we all would have to stop and think if we were in their place, if we were in Mexico.
Exactly.
How would we react
to
what we would be treated? So I think it's something we really have to think about.
Well, there's a lot of Americans who go overseas think they're still king over there. Mm-hmm. And they walk all over the other cultures and have no right to do that either. Mm-hmm. And this has become an unfortunate way of life among many Americans.
If you want to say that the Hispanic, that we don't need to be concerned about their culture, you can, if you want to see that actually in practice, go overseas and live for a while and see how the North Americans, most of the North Americans, live down there, outside of the missionaries and church people like that, but businessmen and diplomats and all of the rest. Most of our diplomats in Latin America don't speak Spanish. Some of them do. Most of them don't. They act like that culture is foreign to them and it's not necessary for them even there to adapt to that culture. And yet, if they come back here, they expect other people that come to live here to adapt to our culture, you see. It's really quite a contradiction. But because of the differences that I mentioned before between Northern Europeans and Hispanics, how the cultures are so different or so similar in the one case and so different in the other, that makes it a lot more difficult for the people also. And it's, you must need, I think, need to remember too that it's much harder for them to understand you because they are the foreigners and they are hearing a different language and they are meeting also a different culture. So they are struggling with all of that too. If our concern really is to bring the gospel to them, then we ought to be concerned about this, I think, so that we can present to the gospel to them in ways that are both appealing and acceptable. My sister works over in Japan. She came back one time and told us that in Japan there are two things about meals, you know, that you do that you would never do in the United States. When you eat soup, you take the bowl and you hold it up to your mouth and just kind of shovel it in. You know, that's the accepted way of doing it. We think that very impolite. And then if you really enjoyed the meal, what you need to do is to give a loud burp afterwards. Because the louder you burp, the more enjoyable the meal was to you. Well, if a Japanese came over to your house and did that, you know, you'd begin to think, what is he, is he trying to insult us, you know? But he's doing what he thinks is best for you. Another incident that I read about, I'll preface it with, when we first went to Guatemala, we were told that you know have to be careful about the foods you eat or where you buy food, and don't buy ice cream because you'll get dysentery and there's all kinds of germs in it, and the milk is not pasteurized and so on. So you have to be very, very careful about what you eat. I read in Time magazine one time several years later that a Japanese diplomat was traveling all around the United States and he would cook food in a hotel room. And of course, in most hotel rooms, that's forbidden, but he brought his little electric plate and cooked his own food. And finally, they asked him, why are you doing that? There's restaurants and all of that. And he said, oh, you can't trust the food here. So you see, it's the same thing. They think, they feel the same way that we feel about our things as we feel about theirs.
I think it's interesting when you have foreign exchange students that live with you for a year. You learn mm-hmm. a lot about
oh,
culture
yeah.
and other
you
lands.
Bet.
It really has made a big difference.
You bet. Okay, one of the other things that our time is getting close to the end that I would just like to talk to you a little bit about is how easy it is for us to contribute to a welfare syndrome that they might have. Now, a lot of the Hispanics, because they are working in seasonal work and they get very low wages, and because of their whole concept of the enjoyment of life and that work is to make life possible rather than living to work, as many Americans think, they will work, let's say, all summer long, and then at some fiesta or something for maybe within a week or 2 weeks, they've spent all the money that they might have saved during the summer, which they usually don't save too much. As it comes in, they buy the things that they want and so on. And then during the off season, they don't have enough money coming in, and so those who can live off of welfare through the children that they get. Now it's important to know that if you're an alien here, and particularly undocumented, you cannot get any kind of welfare help. You can get free medical help or that kind of thing that's offered to everybody without question. But if you want to go in and get federal help or federal welfare, you can't get it. If they have children who are born here in the United States who are citizens, they can get welfare help for the children, which of course benefits the whole family. But all of this has kind of created a sense of dependency among many of the Hispanics. It's kind of like a slave mentality, you know, built up among the slaves that for generations perhaps, or even less than that, were in slavery. So that after the Civil War, for instance, a lot of the slaves didn't know what to do with themselves. They were free. They didn't know how to live. They were suddenly cut free from all of everything that they ever knew, the whole life that they ever knew, and now suddenly had to be on their own to get their food, their clothing, and housing, and all the rest, and they didn't know how to do it. So that some of them, if I read my history right, went back and wanted to work on the very plantations that they had been freed from. See? That's a different kind of mentality that has built up. And they have this dependency mentality. And it's kind of hard for us to keep from building that mindset up or reinforcing that mindset among them. One of the ways that we do it, which is very common, is to think, well, they're poor, we'll give them food, we'll give them used clothing, we'll give them a Christmas basket and a Thanksgiving basket and so on. That is often needed. They often need emergency help. But if that's all that we're thinking about, we're not doing too well for them. But really, what we're really doing finally is reinforcing the concept that if they don't have anything to do, they can simply come and they have the places where they can come and get it for free. Well, our time is up, I guess, or will soon be. Thank you for attending, and hope to see you all over there and at Vespers.